Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Really, there's just one question to ask. You're kidding, right? The dollar's getting crushed, oil's basically at 100 bucks, and still the Dow's over 13,000? Yeah, there was some selling today, but what economy is Wall Street looking at anyway? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, the 7th of November today. Good to have you with us. It was pretty easy to figure out what was going to be sold off on Wall Street today. All you had to do was look for anything labeled stock, and it was going to go down. All 30 Dow components finished the day lower than where they started. General Motors led the way with a $39 billion quarterly loss. That's not a typo. $39 billion is the actual number. And get this, CEO Rick Wagoner said part of it was due to subprimes. That's for a car company. By the closing bell, the major indices had given it up by about 2.5% apiece. Take a look around at the rest of the economy. It's pretty obvious Wall Street's been needing a reality check for some time now. Marketplace's Bob Moon looked into what happens if investors overdose on the bad news.
Wall Street's recent euphoria finally gave way to worries over the ever-deepening subprime credit crisis, the weakening dollar, and record oil prices. The risk now is the market could swing too far in the opposite direction. Tim Hayes is chief investment strategist for Ned Davis Research.
What happens when you go from extreme optimism back toward, you know, new concerns coming to the forefront, then the momentum begins to shift. And really what then you need to look for is to see if we get excessive pessimism that we really factored in too much of the bad news.
Hayes says it's safer to take a wait-and-see approach to the stock market right now, mindful that it's long overdue for a big correction.
We haven't had what's called a cyclical bear market since 2002. This is really one of the longest periods we've ever seen, going back all the way to the beginning of the 1900s. To go this long without anything more than a 10% correction in the major averages is really unusual.
But even as the trading floor was shifting, figuratively at least, at the New York Stock Exchange today, Seaport Securities broker Ted Weisberg was still sounding optimistic.
I just think that we're going through a difficult period. I think we understand why we're going through a difficult period. The big question is, how long will it take for us to work through the softness in the real estate market and to work through the problems in many of the big, large financial institutions?
Economists caution that those aren't the only risks, but Weisberg is still able to see a silver lining even in rising oil prices.
If oil is up because economies are good and there's a lot of demand out there, yes, it's inflationary, and yes, it costs more at the pump, but it also is a reflection of growth.
Weisberg says it still comes down to whether the glass is half empty or half full. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's entirely possible that when we all look back to figure out when the wheels truly came off this economy, the 7th of November is going to be circled in red ink. The dollar took a beating today thanks to some comments overnight from a Chinese official. He hinted it might be time for Beijing to put more of its $1.4 trillion worth of foreign reserves into something other than the greenback. And speaking of that, there's oil. The connection is that oil's a dollar-denominated commodity. And so with the dollar dropping to record lows today against almost every other currency out there, the people who sell oil want more dollars for it. Anyway, it was close. Another record high today, but not quite triple digits. Crude hit $98.62 a barrel at one point this morning. It tumbled pretty quickly after that on some better-than-expected inventory reports. But still, it's generally accepted that $100 a barrel isn't a question of if, but rather when. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looked into just how painful that might be, both here and abroad.
Expensive crude oil isn't likely to sink the U.S. economy, but higher fuel prices could hurt our trading partners.
That's what should raise more concerns.
That's Severin Borenstein with the University of California Energy Institute. With other countries required to pay more for energy, he says they'll have less money to spend on American imports.
That's more likely to lead to a dampening in worldwide demand that could cause a worldwide economic downturn.
On the domestic front, gas prices are up 85 cents a gallon compared to last year, and heating oil is near a record high. Stephen Brown with the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas estimates that for homeowners to fill an average 250-gallon tank, it will cost...
Let me get my calculator out here, 250. That's going to be $135 more each time they fill the heating oil tank.
Higher crude prices creep into the economy in other ways. Airfares are up. Both truckers and FedEx are raising rates. But UC Berkeley's Severin Borenstein says many increases will be less obvious.
Once you get to the supermarket and the drugstore and the other places we buy things retail, we probably really won't notice it on any one good very much. But overall, we'll just see a gradual increase in prices.
It may be gradual, but it adds up. Borenstein calculates that with oil prices up $30 over the past couple of months, the country is spending an extra $200 billion a year on oil, some of it eventually coming out of your pocket. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The talk in Washington today was about spending of a different sort. Last night, the House overturned the president's veto of a big water bill, $23 billion for flood control and environmental restoration projects around the country. The Senate is set to do the same thing this afternoon, which will make this bill the first veto override Mr. Bush has had to deal with. Right about here, we're obliged to point to the calendar again and note that we've got 364 days until the presidential election. As our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, the stage is now set for a political fight over fiscal responsibility.
Congress hasn't delivered any of a dozen budget bills to the White House a month into the fiscal year, and the president is threatening to veto just about every one.
It's to assert an image of fiscal conservatism.
Thomas Mann at the Brookings Institution says spending growth during the president's first 6 years in office means now he's a born-again fiscal conservative.
This is a symbolic fight for the most part in which the president, supported by just enough House Republicans, has decided to pick a fight to kind of rouse the conservative base.
Democrats say their bills support much-needed health, education, security, and veterans programs. Maya McGinnis with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget says the finer points of the arguments are lost on the public.
Most voters, they just know that the White House keeps talking about those big spending Democrats. That's the picture the Republicans are trying to paint.
But Norman Ornstein at the American Enterprise Institute says today's veto override shows certain programs have bipartisan support, and some Republicans think the White House veto strategy might cost them.
Once you've had one overridden, it makes it easier for people to do it another time. And it undercuts your argument that this is all about excessive spending when a very, very substantial number of your own Republicans defects. So it's significant.
Congress is likely to reset the deadline for final spending bills from mid-November to mid-December. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street opened down today and then went down some more. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Free trade made its way to the House of Representatives today. Lawmakers are voting on a deal with Peru that the Bush administration signed a year and a half ago. The White House is still waiting for Congress to decide on trade agreements with Panama and Colombia. Back during the 2000 presidential campaign, George Bush promised to make Latin America, and this is a quote, a fundamental commitment of his presidency. Andres Oppenheimer and others say that commitment's been honored mostly in the breach. He writes about Latin America for the Miami Herald. Mr. Oppenheimer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Do me a favor and rank free trade or trade in general on the list of things bubbling about in the U.S.-Latin American relationship.
Well, it's a big, big thing because Latin American countries that have had free trade agreements with the U.S., like Mexico, Chile, Central American countries most recently, have substantially increased their exports. Now, some people say it's been bad for their agricultural businesses. The truth is, it has been bad for some isolated cases of agricultural businesses. But if you look at Mexico, for instance, free trade almost quadrupled over the past since 1994. So looking at it from Latin America's perspective, it's been a great thing.
Look at it from Washington's perspective for me for a moment, though. What happens if Washington doesn't get the free trade formula right?
Well, first of all, Venezuela is making a big move to sort of become the major regional power in Latin America. And as we know, President Hugo Chavez would love to see the U.S. influence decline in the region. But there are other players. In the book, I talk extensively about China. This is sort of not very well known in the U.S., but in Latin America, wherever you go, you see a growing Chinese influence, mostly trade-wise. The Chinese are buying Argentine soybeans like crazy, Brazilian soybeans, Chilean copper, Peruvian iron ore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
As you traveled through Latin America in reporting this book, and you went out and talked to people, not government officials and not high-ranking corporate people, but people who are actually doing the buying and selling, are they interested in having a trade relationship with the United States?
Of course. People in Latin America know that the U.S. is the biggest market in the world, and that they want to sell more goods to the U.S. In some cases, they find trade barriers. For instance, the countries in South America, Argentina, Brazil, the agricultural countries, face problems exporting their agricultural goods because of farm subsidies in this country. Other countries want free trade agreements, like Peru today, and find that the U.S. Congress is reluctant to approve them.
You mentioned that the Chinese need Latin America to fuel its own economic growth. Does the United States need Latin America for the same reason?
Well, the U.S. needs Latin America perhaps more than ever. The United States exports $225 billion worth of goods annually to Latin America. That's incredibly a lot more than the $55 billion we export to China, or the $10 billion we export to India.
Let me ask you about the subtitle to this book. It's called Saving the Americas, The Dangerous Decline of Latin America and What the U.S. Must Do. What about what Latin America must do?
Latin America must do a lot of things, and I spent a big chunk of the book talking about that. It has to reduce its absurd subsidies. It has to become more business-friendly. It has to attract more investments. It has to improve its education standards. And first of all, it has to stop blaming others for its own shortcomings. There's no shortage of criticism for Latin America in the book, believe me.
Andres Oppenheimer is a syndicated columnist with the Miami Herald. His newest book is called Saving the Americas, The Dangerous Decline of Latin America and What the U.S. Must Do. Mr. Oppenheimer, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
A key part of the trade relationship between the United States and Latin America is cash. Foreign workers in this country send tens of billions of dollars back home. Mexicans living abroad, many of them here in the United States, are expected to send more than $25 billion this year. Most of that will go to their families. But communities benefit, too, thanks to a matching program with a twist. From KUT in Austin, Joy Diaz has the story.
Ever since Esteban Castillo was a child, the plaza in his hometown has been in disrepair. Castillo grew up in San Nicolás, a small town in central Mexico. He remembers the trees in the plaza had grown so much that the roots had cracked the cement around the benches.
Often when people were walking around chatting, they would trip over and fall. They will kid around and say that our plaza was so spectacular that it made people fall in awe of it.
Castillo is 48 now. He left Mexico for Texas more than 30 years ago. He fixes heavy-duty tires in Austin for a living. Although he's thousands of miles away, he has always hoped he could do something about the plaza, but the repairs would run more than $60,000. Then, last year, Castillo was at the Mexican consulate in Austin. He heard about a program that could help him fix his beloved plaza. He could send money back to Mexico for repairs, and the government would match his donation. The program is called Tres por Uno, or Three for One, Ambassador Jorge Guajardo.
Whether it be schools, public places, lightning, whatever it be, for every dollar the Mexicans living abroad put into this program, the federal government adds $1, the state government adds another dollar, and the municipal government adds another dollar.
Castillo told some friends about Tres por Uno. In June, they started sending money back home for the project, but many Mexicans are still skeptical about the program. Brian Roberts leads the Mexican Center at the University of Texas.
The historical memory of these communities, if you talk to people here, one of the first things they'll say is, well, we wouldn't trust our home state governor, etc., to have charge of our money.
Other critics say Tres por Uno sounds like the Mexican government is encouraging its citizens to leave. Then they will send money back home and fund the country's programs. Since 2002, Tres por Uno has brought in $300 million and grown from a handful of projects into more than 1,000 last year. Agustin Escobar is a social anthropologist in Guadalajara. He has studied the program since it began in 2002. He says the biggest problem with Tres por Uno is that it's too small.
Out of every $1,000 that go back to Mexico, about $2 are invested in this program. So if we wanted it to grow, say, to at least 10 times its present size, which would be very good for public works in Mexico, you would really have to increase the bureaucracies. And that's something that the government is not willing to do.
One thing the government has done is match donations coming from the U.S. quickly. Remember Esteban Castillo? He recently visited San Nicolás. He says the work on the plaza is moving along. He and his friends plan to have a ribbon cutting next year for the town's annual celebration of its patron saint. In Austin, I'm Joy Diaz for Marketplace.
Coming up, why some companies don't want to hire reservists.
They're bringing someone into the company and then they lose them. And they don't have any say over it. So if we get deployed, we get deployed. There's nothing they can do.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, you know, I knew it was going to be the wah-wah trombones today. The Dow Industrials plummeted 2.6%, 360 points to close at 13,300. The Nasdaq plunged 2.7%, 76 points to close at 2,748. The S&P 500 sank 2.9%, 44 points to end the day at 1475. Washington Mutual crashed more than 17% after the New York Attorney General announced his office will launch a probe into the bank's mortgage practices. Shares of General Motors sputtered down 6%. The automaker posted that huge third quarter loss we told you about. The tech sector was hit today, too. Apple fell 2.8%. Bonds soared. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health and reduce costs for business. AAFP.org/value. And by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. The Labor Department reports on weekly jobless claims. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies before the Joint Economic Committee. And on this day in 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected president for the first time. The following year, he launched the New Deal, a series of economic initiatives aimed at softening the blow of the Great Depression. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a report in the latest issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association about obesity. Apparently, it's more dangerous to the elderly than previously understood. And today, at a meeting of the American Public Health Association, researchers said more kids are taking medicines originally made for adults, specifically to treat diseases caused by eating too much and exercising too little. Commentator David Frum says, for the sake of our healthcare system, it's time for us all to get on the treadmill.
I'm a small government guy. I disapprove of nanny stating. But America's newest public health problem is rapidly turning into a public finance nightmare. Unlike smoking and failure to wear a seatbelt, obesity does not greatly shorten life. Instead, obesity exposes the obese to chronic illness. From depression to workplace injury, obesity and excessive weight are implicated in a startling range of costly health problems. The Centers for Disease Control estimate that more than one health dollar in 10 is spent to counter the effects of obesity. And since the federal government is the largest single buyer of health care, the burden of overweight is squashing the taxpayer. And this is likely to get worse, not only as the baby boomers age, but because younger generations are proving even more susceptible. Today's adolescents are three times more likely to be overweight than in 1980. Some of the necessary solutions involve changes at the most local level. Schools should ban soft drink machines, as many already do. Recess and phys ed, often eliminated from school timetables, should be enhanced. Zoning policies often inadvertently make driving more necessary. A simple, unconsidered decision today, allowing Segways to use sidewalks, may have serious consequences tomorrow. Above all, there is a job of education to be done. One important recent survey found that having overweight friends increases one's own chances of gaining weight. Apparently, being surrounded by overweight people alters our assumptions about what is and what is not a healthy weight. Ominously, America's weight expectations are altering in unhealthy ways. But hey, here's an idea. One of the 2008 presidential candidates, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, has set a marvelous personal example. He lost 100 pounds and kept it off. All the candidates are talking about energy. Maybe it's time we had one who talked about masks.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President Bush. At the moment, he's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Take a moment to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. This Sunday, the 11th of November, is Veterans Day. Some of you might have the day off in observance on Monday. But increasingly, veterans who continue their service in the reserves are having a tough time getting jobs in the first place. Danielle Carson reports.
Discipline and leadership under fire. Those are the military's currency. Service members hope to cash in on those skills when they go back to civilian life.
I was a team leader with three guys under me. So you're talking about a guy that had no self-confidence is now leading three guys and a completely different person.
Jason Boyd served in Iraq for 6 months as an infantryman with the Marines. The 23-year-old was honorably discharged in February and is now in the ready reserve, meaning he could be deployed anytime he's needed. He sent out as many as 70 resumes that listed his ready reserve status. He got one call back.
I sent in my resume. They said it looked great. They would call me back, and they never did. Because I think for them, they're bringing someone into the company and then they lose them. And they don't have any say over it. So if we get deployed, we get deployed. There's nothing they can do.
Reluctance to hire a service member is nothing new. Kimberly Smith has been in the Army Reserve for almost 25 years. She knows for a fact she didn't get a job back in 1988 because of her status.
I got a phone call from the warehouse manager, and he said, you know, I'd really like to offer you a position, but I really have a problem with this one weekend a month thing. And I said, are you saying you're not hiring me because I'm in the Army Reserve? And he said, well, yeah.
Under federal law, a company has to hold a guard member's job for as long as they're gone, and that requirement has discouraged many businesses, especially smaller ones, from hiring service members. Former Marine Dan Caulfield.
Are they going to hire somebody that's going to be deployed in the next 6 to 12 months, and are they going to be doing this hiring all over again to fill a spot? So it's absolutely a problem that we see across our blogs and in our daily chat rooms.
Caulfield founded the online network Hire a Hero this past January with charitable donations. The site has more than 180,000 job seekers, and so far, more than 800 mid- to large-sized businesses have registered. But it's slow going. Former infantryman Jason Boyd finally landed a job. But along the way, one job recruiter told him many employers look down on service members as automatons.
She said, it's the fact that military people have to be told when to tie their boots. And I laughed, and I said, I was a lance corporal with three guys under me, and I was the one making all the decisions.
But Caulfield finds that many big companies are willing to hire people like Boyd. They figure if somebody can keep their cool while taking fire, they can handle an irate boss. And a bigger firm can afford to temporarily fill a job if a new hire heads overseas, like Sodexo. The food and facilities management company employs thousands of guardsmen and reservists. Spokesman Anthony Owen says his company is happy to bite the bullet.
We have military employees that serve one, two, and sometimes three tours. So we know that on any given moment, they could be called away. But when they come back, we look forward to their return just as well.
Hire a Hero's Caulfield says corporations should do what's best for them, and his mission is compatible with that.
I believe that what we need to do for corporate America is make it in their best interest to hire these young people. And I have made a living at helping corporations recognize the value of hiring these young people. And the value far outweighs the sacrifices that they have to make to support the Guard and Reserve.
One of Caulfield's talking points is that taxpayers have already sunk thousands of dollars into training service members. So businesses can get a free return on society's investment by welcoming people back to the civilian workplace. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Consumed, American Public Media's special series exploring the sustainability of our consumer culture. Online at consumed.publicradio.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes to update you on some stories we've been covering. We told you a couple of weeks ago about a property rights law in Oregon that's led to an explosion of billboards on the state's otherwise pristine roadways. Yesterday, citizens of the Beaver State revolted. They rolled back those property rights in off-year elections. Also, an addendum to our final yesterday on Radiohead's new album, In Rainbows. Yes, more than half of the band's fans paid exactly $0 for the download. But the band still likely made a pretty penny. There are no official sales figures out there yet, but Billboard guesses the band could rake in as much as $4.5 million from those downloads, no record company to pay off. Thanks to listeners out there who pointed that out to us, and there were more than just a couple of you, I'll tell you that. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow heaved off 360 points, 2.6%. The Nasdaq lurched down 76 points, 2.7%. The S&P 500 tanked 44 points, 2.9%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornone, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineered the program for us. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, the redemptive power of hoops.
I feel God has been very, very kind to me by using basketball to shape my own life.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.